hello, and welcome to the House Einstein podcast. This is podcast 20. I am Osman Parvez with House Einstein, and with me is Hamish Crabb.
Hello, hello. What are we talking about today, Oz?
Well, hold on before we get started.
Oh, yeah.
We've got our disclaimer. It's been a few weeks. I was at a very important conference in the Nevada desert that had some mud at it. I've been out of pocket for a couple of weeks, so it's been a little while. And we might talk about that, or we might not. But we have a disclaimer before we jump in, and that this podcast is not legal advice. This podcast is not real estate advice. If you are a client and you want real estate advice, call me or call your House Einstein agent if you're not one of my clients. And we're more than happy to advise you or reach out to us via email as a client. But if you're just listening to this podcast, or even if you're a client listening to this podcast, this is not real estate advice. This is entertainment. And that keeps our attorneys happy. This is not legal advice either. And we'll be talking about some legal matters in this podcast from an informed but not legal expert perspective. All right. Yep. Sound good? Did I cover it?
I think you nailed it.
Okay. Topics. So if what we're intending to cover in this podcast is a failure to disclose issue that is now a lawsuit on a property very close to my house, actually, in Four Mile Canyon here in Boulder. We're also going to be talking about negotiation techniques, high-end deals, and competent versus incompetent negotiation. We're going to talk about losing a listing and the price of having a life, or I should say the price of having a life. And we're going to talk about pricing risk specific to unknowns like scary sewer line inspection issues or potential power lines that have not yet been built. And we're also going to talk about, if there's time, we'll talk about the high interest rate environment that we're currently seeing here in Colorado and across the country, and also how we are starting to get involved with creative finance deals and how more challenging they can be. So those are our topics, and we're going to hit them one at a time.
In a beautiful conversational fashion.
Seamless. Yeah. No issues, just seamless with the magic of technology. So, first topic, I got a message from a past client on WhatsApp this morning with a link to a property in Boulder. So we can talk about this property because it's closed. We can't talk about active listings, but closed deals we can talk about. I won't mention much about the agents involved because I don't know the agents, at least that represented the seller. I haven't even looked to see who represented the buyer. But it's a really interesting property. So this is a very large home at 500 Arroyo Chico. And this home apparently has high arsenic and uranium, radioactive material in the water. And the buyer ended up having health issues. The seller was or is the founder of a water purification systems company, perhaps an expert on that. It's not entirely clear. So let's look at the Denver Post article, Hamish. I'm going to pull it up on my own screen and make sure we have the Post article right, because that's really the basis of what we know so far. But first things first, this property caught my eye when it was on the market, and I almost wrote about it, and I almost went to go see it because it was just so interesting. I sent it to a friend of mine who was thinking about starting a retreat center, and we weren't sure if the zoning would allow for the use that he wanted to apply to this property, but I did send it to him because he had a dream of starting a retreat center. The property was first listed on the market in 2014 at $4.8 million.
Wow.
And it was on the market for 200 days. They cut it to $3.8 million, and then 2 months later, they said, no, it's worth even more. And they upped it to 5.2, unclear what caused it to jump from 3.8 to 5.2. And then it was withdrawn from the market in June of 2016. 4 months later, it came back, now at a price of $3.4 million. and it was on the market for 400 days and then withdrawn. Jeez. And then it just fully expired in September. The listing expired in September 2018. So in November 2017, it was withdrawn. In September 2018, it expired. We could talk about the technical status differences perhaps another time. And then it came back in 2019, this time at $3 million. And nobody bought it. And a little over 2 months later, they dropped it from just under $3 million, $2.995,500. They dropped it to $2.75. Or really 2.745,500. I'm just going to round up for simplicity. And then it went under contract in August of 2020. And that person had it under contract for almost 30 days. And then it got kicked back out. And then it went under contract again. So this is, it sat on the market from that date, September 2020, to June of 2021. And then it went under contract at the end of June of 2021. And it eventually sold in September 2021. And that's the history.
The full listing.
Yeah, it sold eventually it sold for $2.46 million, which is, you know, less than, it's basically half of the original list price years and years ago. And of course, during this time we saw lots of inflation. We also saw rapid gain in appreciation of real estate. And so to see a property go from almost $5 million and selling for 2.5 is, it must have been pretty painful for the sellers. So it closed in September of 2021. And then this article in the Post, let's go to that. If I can find it here, Denver Post wants me to log in, which I can do. This is where, you know, having that shared screen, Hamish, if we were doing this together, it would be so useful. Where you can say, hey, Hamish, pull that up. 500 Arroyo, and there it is. And the headline is, and this is from 2 days ago, family of five was poisoned by arsenic found in Boulder Monastery's well, lawsuit alleges. And it says the Beckers bought the house for $2.5 million, and then they got sick. The married couple, they bought this giant, oh, wants me to log in. Okay, guess I'm going to have to log in.
I know. I ran through so many ad issues to get to watch, to get to view the page.
Yeah. I mean, I subscribe, so this shouldn't be a big deal. Okay, there we go. So they asked the sellers about a disturbing rumor they heard, and the rumor is a neighborhood grown irate and poisoned the monastery's water well, but it was only a tall tale, a false threat from environmental activists, the couple was told. Now, I'm not sure if that happened before or after they bought the property, but it turns out the property has arsenic and uranium in it, and the family experienced some health issues. And the founder of a water purification company actually built the monastery. And the monastery is huge. I mean, it's got a 30-car garage, a 7,000-square-foot deck, solar panels, a cistern, a greenhouse. The listing also shows that it had a total of 27,000 total square feet, of which 20,000 were finished. And it's sitting on a 14-acre lot. And the photos are absolutely gorgeous. You know, it's very – I mean, for what looks like half house, half retreat center or half office or – I didn't know it was a monastery when I remember looking at it in 2021 and seeing how far the price had dropped. Now, I never actually went inside this property. At the time, I felt like I didn't have a buyer, and previewing it, I was just too busy. But it was very intriguing. I remember seeing it. And so now there's this lawsuit. And the lawsuit says that Selby, this is the founder of the water purification company and developer and seller of the house, bought hundreds of cheap acres in Boulder's Four Mile Canyon while a student, and then sold or developed them for decades afterward. And in the 90s, he built this monastery over the outcries of an environmentalist group called Residents Against Inappropriate Development, or RAID, that he accused of using radical tactics. And the Beckers, the buyers, toured the property with the sellers and said there were some red flags. A realtor refused to say why a sale fell through. And the sellers drank from bottled water. And of course, that poisoning rumor. Okay, so they knew about the rumor when they toured it. But the sellers and their agents assured the buyers that all was well with the water. And when they
drank bottled water.
Yeah, all's fine, but we're drinking from bottled water. And then the buyer found a disconnected water filtration system. The seller told him the water was so good, filtering was unnecessary. And so they bought it, and then they got sick. And it sounds like they didn't actually test the water. And what they found when they finally did in April of 2023, that's this year, they found extremely dangerous levels of arsenic and unsafe levels of uranium. And a filtration system has alleviated some symptoms, but others remain. And the Beckers now face increased cancer risk for the rest of their lives.
Easily.
And I think one of their children has some developmental issues. That was in the other article. And so now they're suing the seller and the seller's realtors. I'm not sure if they're also suing the buyer's realtors. But there's lawyers involved, and I'm sure nobody's commenting because it's a lawsuit. And it looks to me like the buyers actually did not have their own representation based on the MLS for the sold listing. It's the same agent. So the buyers went with the seller's agent. Ooh. So this is going to, yeah. So a couple of things. As an employing broker and somebody with ethics and integrity, I can tell you that we disclose what we know, and we tell our sellers to disclose what they know. And the law says you should do that proactively, not wait to be asked. So if a seller comes to me and says, look, we have uranium in the water, it's probably fine. We don't really know, but I know I had this test result and it's probably okay. I would say we have a problem because I now know. If I didn't know, I wouldn't disclose what I don't know. But now that I know, I have to proactively disclose this to all potential buyers.
Yeah. Which is for the best, especially in this scenario. I mean,
any scenario. So we started working this week with a new client who has fired their buyer's agent, who was basically, in their words, a pushover over a mold non-disclosure issue. So on first showing, no mold, asked the sellers, are there any mold issues, said no. And then lo and behold, mold has been disclosed once they're under contract. And I think it might have been in the SPD. And that caused them significant alarm, and they fired their realtor, and they terminated their contract, all over a failure to disclose issue. And it may not be that it was truly a failure to disclose, and from a legal perspective, it might have been on the SPD, but it lent the buyers an impression of shady behavior by the seller. And that's all you need. The moment you think the seller is doing something shady, you wonder what else they're hiding, and you terminate.
Yep. Yeah, it takes one kind of sketchy signal, and then suddenly there's far less trust in the deal.
Well, ten years ago, we had floods here in Boulder, and social media is constantly reminding me of this right now with lots of photos I took and posted. And a lot of the photos show all the cleanup efforts involved, and that's really a powerful reminder of how amazing our community is here in Boulder. Like, people just form teams, and, you know, we organized, self-organized into cleanup crews and cleaned each other's houses and basements and demoed basements that got wet, hauled that stuff to the dump for so many people. But afterward, mold suddenly became an issue for homes that were not properly mitigated. Everyone asks, did the home get flood damage in 2013, or should ask that question when they look at a basement? Not necessarily as critical for homes without a basement or crawl space, ranch style houses built slab on grade, but definitely important to ask if their house has a crawl space or a basement. And usually we can see signs of mold in unfinished parts of the basement on the wood framing. You can usually see that it got wet, or you can see a flood cut. And that then begs the question, why is there a flood cut? And was this disclosed in the SPD? The seller's property disclosure. And if they're hiding something, yeah, it just creates so much distrust. My first deal was, I think, 2014 or 15, and I was working with a couple who we went through this process with. We put a property under contract in Martin Acres. It was a tri-level house on one of those little circles, and the SPD did not say anything about flood damage. We had negotiated the terms of the deal, and now we were on the inspection process. And before we complete the inspection process, I encourage my clients to let's go walk the neighborhood and see what we can learn from the neighbors about the house. And
neighbors
I was with
the
them.
Best.
Yeah, They'll the neighbors
tell you
are the
everything.
Or the worst. And this neighbor said, so we said, how did this home do in the floods? And oh, there was water totally up and down the street. It was a big deal. I was like, that's weird because the SPD says there was no flood damage to this house. And the neighbor's like, there were sandbags everywhere trying to divert water that had been flooding into that house. And I was like, oh, that's weird. I called the listing agent. I said, your SPD says no flood damage, but the neighbor said there was so much water heading into that house that the sellers tried to divert it with sandbags. Can you tell us what's going on here? And he said, I have never heard any of that. I will call you back. And half an hour later, he called me back and said, I talked to the seller and they didn't think that was flood damage.
It's just moisture. It's not water.
Like it's not. And I'm like, what did you need? Like a full river? Not a stream? Like
some rapids?
Like what would constitute flood damage? But my buyer was so upset. They terminated and they actually were upset with me too. I lost them as clients over that, which it wasn't my fault, but sometimes you blame the messenger. And there was nothing I could do about that other than to learn to set expectations about sellers not being honest on the SPD and to make sure we're doing our own due diligence to the best of our ability. And since then, I learned to quite easily spot what looks like flood damage. At that point, I hadn't seen it before, but now I've seen it so many times that usually we see it before the inspection. We don't even need to wait for the inspection.
Yeah. And you know, with all the experience at this point, it's almost kind of like an unfortunate happenstance or kind of scenario in where it's an estate sale, right? Where the house may have a bunch of things that would have been disclosed if the owner were still around, but can no longer, you know, the surviving estate doesn't know anything. And so you get into this kind of can of worms where nothing's necessarily disclosed.
I find that to be a lie. When they tell me that it's an estate sale, the family doesn't know anything. The parents hid every aspect of their lives. They never mentioned flood damage. I find that I don't know anything answer to be really suspicious. So my parents right now are selling their house in upstate New York. I grew up in that house. And I know of some of the issues they've had in that house. I'm not the agent involved. I'm not, you know, I just know because I grew up in that house. So, and I don't know New York State's disclosure laws or any of the rest of that thing. I don't even want to get into their property. But the point I'm trying to make is that if I were to inherit that house and fill out a seller's property disclosure, I definitely would tell you what I know. Because claiming I know nothing is absolutely a lie. And whoever is advising whoever is advising sellers to choose that option, I think is doing their client a disservice and increasing the liability that they get sued later. When you bought this house, Hamish, and the seller didn't disclose a bunch of moisture issues and structural issues and said it's an estate sale. It's your first home.
Yeah.
And you found out there's a lot of issues. Now, what if you call the contractor that said, oh, yeah, I'm the one that, you know, gave them estimates for repair of this 2 years ago.
Yeah. Is that like room for recourse?
It is room for recourse. Now, recourse isn't free, right? Hiring attorneys, that's not what realtors do. You would have to hire an attorney and you would have to go after them. And you might get damages, but you may not get attorney fees. And the numbers may not make it worth the effort because it takes years and a significant amount of money to go through the court process. If it's less than $7,500, that number may have moved up. But if it's less than $7,500, you could take them to small claims court yourself. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, you're in district court and you're racking up some serious expenses. So it has to be a big number to go after them.
Okay.
Plus, it's also distracting, right?
Yeah. And I'm supposed to be working.
It's just the question is, do you want that in your life? My ex got rear-ended in a car accident years ago. And the person who rear-ended her had bald tires. And she did have serious injuries, like neck whiplash style injuries. Mm. And in the end, we decided not to pursue any damages because of the amount of psychological energy it would take. It just wasn't worth it. And she, like yourself, is Kiwi and didn't feel like that's how we do things in in our culture.
The Kiwi way, bygones.
The Kiwi way, let it go and move on. So back to this arsenic house, this arsenic poisoned house. I don't know any of the facts of the case. I was not a agent involved in this deal. I don't even know the listing agent who also apparently represented who transaction brokered the deal.
There are three agents being sued.
Yeah. I mean, I can see the listing agent's name. I don't know these other names. I don't know why there are three agents on it, but there's only one name on the MLS. And interestingly, in the MLS, it says, listing broker must be present at all showings and contract fell out due to buyer's personal situation. House has been through 6 days of inspections, including structural and septic. Well, not water. So if you're buying a home in the mountains, you absolutely should test the water quality. And it's not just for arsenic, it's also for PFAS, the persistent firefighting chemicals that are sometimes found in places like Formal Canyon that had fires. And I think an RO system can remove most of contamination. You may want to remineralize the water afterward. I've heard that that's a good idea, but like our water well had high nitrate when we bought this house, nothing else. But my wife and I were talking this morning and we plan to test annually now because if there is arsenic poisoning, I mean, it's possible it came from a, you know, mining activity decades ago, but water moves. It doesn't stay in one spot. So,
and it erodes the things around it, you know.
A neighbor 4 miles away has a poisoned arsenic well. There's a good chance our well is going to have arsenic too. So we're going to start testing and see how that goes. But, and I don't know if there's any merits to this case or not. The take-home lessons are not about about this particular home. It's about making sure you do your own due diligence. And frankly, you should hire a buyer's agent because the seller's agent represents the seller. And even if they check that box that says now they're transaction brokers, they still have a pre-existing relationship with the seller and their loyalty is to the seller, whether or not they check that box. And the other option is customer and they represent the seller. At least that's more honest than transaction broker. It's my least favorite box to check when people ask me to do it. I will. And then everything goes online and I share everything I know. And I'm doing every possible thing I can to neutralize the favoritism I'm going to have to the seller. But even then, the seller chose me to represent them.
There's so much room for that, you know, for bias at that point. Yeah.
Well,
for favoritism.
And there's also a conflict of interest with the commissions. Now you're being paid more, right? So you've got a giant financial incentive to make sure this deal happens. And you represent, originally you represented the sellers and now you switch to neutral status. I don't like it. I don't think it should exist. I don't think transaction brokerage should be an option. I think people think it's dual brokerage. It incentivizes brokers to do the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. At the minimum, get somebody else from the team, which maybe that's why there's three agents here.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. That's true. The MLS may not accurately reflect the fact that the buyers were represented by somebody else, but the MLS says they were represented by the same agent that listed the property.
Yeah.
So that's
possible.
Could
be the case.
But if it was another agent on the team, their name should be there as the buyer's agent, not this agent.
Oh, it should be reported correctly. Yeah.
Yeah. And it says the contract was an exclusive right to sell agency agreement. So I don't know. I'm not an attorney. I'm not involved with this deal. The take-home lessons are not about these agents. Although I have personally found agents do not do what they should do, which is proactively disclose material defects that are known to the agent about the property. And I tell my sellers that when we're going through an inspection process, once you get that inspection report and it says this house has these defects, you have to disclose that legally to all buyers. And so do I.
Yeah.
So we can
Let's
try to
not
work this
beat
out.
Around.
Yeah. which is why Oliver used to say, who's a famous attorney who advised real estate agents here in Colorado for many years, he used to say that if your buyer is not serious about buying the house, just terminate. Do not send the inspection objection notice. Do not send the inspection report if your buyer is just getting out anyway, because all you're doing is poisoning the well, so to speak, for the next buyer. But in practice, you're also, I would say, forcing the seller to now disclose what's wrong with the house.
That's where I am on it. It feels more ethical to be like, hey, there's a bunch of issues, you know.
That's probably the right thing to do, is to send them the inspection report. But if you're trying to protect your colleagues, you don't. We had a deal two summers ago, where we found serious structural issues. We couldn't negotiate through it, and we walked. And somebody else bought the house at a price that didn't reflect, in our opinion, the issues with that house. And we often wondered, did that seller disclose what we showed them, what we found through the inspection report, or did they hide it? And the buyer has thought about just casually mentioning this to the new owner, but has decided to just stay out of it and not create drama. But we've wondered.
Yeah. I also like, this year we had some heated emails fly back and forth with some colleagues. And, I remember at the end of your lengthy email, basically trying to like make sense of what's going on, you say, hey, by the way, you know, now that you know of this, it's your duty to proactively disclose. Good luck. You know, just reminding agents that they have to.
Yeah. And if it turns out that this agent did not disclose what she actually knew to be true, or these agents, plural, then they deserve to be sued. And I hope that that penalty is widely discussed in real estate continuing ed. And DORA makes a big deal. Our regulatory agency makes a deal over these agents that failed to disclose, because this is a big deal. These people were apparently poisoned by arsenic, allegedly poisoned by arsenic and uranium, and have long-lasting, significant health issues, allegedly. And that's a big deal.
There's a reason you disclose. So I'm trying to think, right, like kind of put myself in the shoes of it a little bit. And we might be kind of nearing the end of this topic. But you go over, you're having your listing consultation with these clients at 500 Arroyo Chico, and you see they're only drinking out of bottled water. But that's as far as it goes, right? Then you don't know anything.
You don't know anything. My parents like drinking. I think bottled water is gross. My parents like bottled water. I find it totally gross. It's plastic. You're drinking microplastics.
It's also unethical, but that's a whole different thing.
That's a whole nother topic. Yeah. But yes, it's also unethical to drink bottled water. Okay. Well, that's an entirely different topic. But you're right. Just seeing them drinking bottled water does not mean that you knew anything. But if they told you that they had a problem with arsenic, or more importantly, if the first buyer – so this is what you should do. You knew the contract fell apart, the first deal. And now you step in, and the agent says to your buyer's agent, the reason the first deal fell apart was personal. They just changed their mind. They had a death in the family. They just couldn't do the deal. It had nothing to do with the house. The house has been fully inspected. We're ready to go.
And I'd say, okay. 6 days of thorough inspection. Right.
Send me the termination note. Once you're under contract, send me the termination notice. And in the termination notice, you will get two things: the checkbox, and you will find out who their agent is. You'll find out what brokers they worked for. You will find out details. You can also ask for the first contract too. You can ask for anything you want. You may not get it, but you should ask for the termination notice. And then if they checked inspection, then the next question is, have you sent me all of the inspection reports that were sent to you? And you can also call the agent. You can also Google the buyer. And if they have a unique name, you might find them and you might get the real story. You should keep digging until you get the real story. If there's any doubt, and this is something a buyer's agent should be doing, but legally is not required to help you with your due diligence.
Yeah,
and this is why our buyer agency has that call out that my attorney wrote, because I feel ethically responsible, knowing what we know, to at least assist our buyers doing their due diligence, and we do that to the best of our ability. Does that mean we're perfect? No, but we're going to do everything we can, and that little carve out in the buyer agency agreement says, Osman will do everything he can, but you're ultimately responsible for the results of your due diligence, because due diligence is not a normal duty of a buyer's agent to their client.
Right. it's a little bit of grace room for us to go above and beyond as when we can and if we can, right?
It's cover your ass language. Let's be honest. It's it's cover your ass language. It's there so we don't get sued, and it allows us also to try to help, because if you go to these classes by continuing ed classes by attorneys, they say you should do nothing with respect to due diligence. You shouldn't even comment about how the house looks like it's been well maintained, because if you say those words and then the plumbing breaks the week after closing, guess who they're going to ask for to pay the plumbing bill? So, well, Osman, you said the plumbing looks good. You said the house was well maintained. It turns out it isn't.
Well, I said it looks good. I didn't say it is good. I feel like that doesn't hold up.
That's a fun defense, Haven.
It's all I've got.
Okay, well, now that you own a house, you need to be more careful about what you say, because they're going to see that you own a house and they're going to want it.
Yeah. I don't know if they will. So. Everybody's getting sick all the time. But I think it's the flu season.
All right. I think we've beaten this topic of disclosure to death with respect to 500 Arroyo Chico. We wish the parties involved justice for all. And I hope all the facts come out. And if there was a failure to disclose issue, which we don't know to be true, but if there was, I hope the people that failed to disclose are penalized for that and do the and make the buyer whole. Although I don't know if they ever can make the buyer whole, given if they have serious long-term health issues related to, you know, an environmental issue with that house.
Yep.
All right.
Check out that article. Check out the article. Check out the pictures. It's a cool place.
Yeah. Check out the pictures. Check out the article. You can see the photos of the house probably on Zillow. And
They're all on Zillow. It looks weird, but it's just vacant.
Okay. And you can also read the article in the Denver Post written by, I don't even know if it has a byline. How funny is that? Oh, there it is. Justin Wingerder. And it's actually republished in the Denver Post. It's from the Denver Business Journal.
Mm.
So, all right. Next topic, much more current and fresh for us.
Mm-hmm.
Negotiation. High-end deals. And competent versus incompetent negotiation. And we probably have talked about this before, but this is so fresh that I feel like I really want to talk about this. This is real estate therapy.
I think that's going forward, though, like podcasts should just be kind of what's top of mind. And then we expand on topics and hit them each time, right? And as we learn and, you know, our opinions may change, or that we could cement what we're doing.
Sure, we can come back to topics and expand on them and learn as we learn more. I mean, that's part of life is learning. And obviously, it's something we care a lot about is learning and improving our skill set. So to the best of my understanding, not just in real estate, but having worked in the investment community prior to real estate, and then also working in the investment banking community in New York, in Boston, mostly equities research, but watching how deals were done and then working on the deal side and the capital markets. Deals are done by people that you trust. Well, deals are sometimes done by people you don't trust, but deals are a lot easier when there's trust and when there's rapport, when there's communication that is human. And this is particularly true for higher end deals, more higher value deals. So the right way to do a deal in real estate, to negotiate a deal on any listing, whether it's a brand new listing with multiple offers or it's a listing that's been on the market for months, is to pick up the phone and call the listing agent and try to get them on the phone. If they're not available, leave a few times. It might be good to reach you. Go back and forth until you talk to them on the phone. And what you say on the phone is, hey, it's Osman with House Einstein. My client saw your beautiful and amazing listing this weekend, and they're seriously thinking about writing an offer. You don't commit to writing an offer. They're seriously thinking about writing an offer. Can we schedule a time to talk on the phone, or can I touch base with you? You get the agent on the phone, and 90% of the purpose of this phone call is to establish communication. It's not to set the terms of the deal. Rapport. And you say, hey, how's it going? Have we done a deal before? It's so nice to meet you. So my buyers love certain things about the house, and they had some questions. And then you start to feel out a little bit, you know, what closing date works best, or you know, are they a little flexible on price, and why are they selling? All of these questions you can ask, and you start to you learn some things through this process, which you then can convey to your principal, the buyer, or if you're the seller, you also learn some things about the buyer. Mm-hmm. And it's natural and it's human. And then you come in with an offer. And that offer is crafted around certain things. Like, was there a closing date that was the best for the seller? You can choose whether you want to go aggressive on price or not. It's a little harder to slap somebody in the face with a super low offer after you've established rapport, but you can still offer low. And you can, well, if we do, I will say, look, we don't mean to offend you with this offer. I'll call. Mm-hmm. Say, I'm trying not to offend you with the offer, but based on these three comps, we can't really see your price point. Or based on my buyer's budget, we can't get any higher than this number. This is going to be this is really close to the maximum that they're going to offer. And I don't say this is the maximum, because one, that pens my client into the corner. And two, it leaves no room for discussion at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So you begin the process with human connection. You don't begin the process with a text message or an email. You can accompany that phone call with text messages and emails, but you really want to establish rapport, and email and text is a really bad way to do that.
This is where the should be verbal comes from in the parentheses here. And you've got to be talking to them.
Well, when they don't do that, right, it mm-hmm. tells me a couple of things. It tells me either it's a very new agent with not a lot of experience in negotiation, or it's somebody that has been in business for a while, but they haven't been a negotiator for a while. So in this particular instance, it's an offer that came in on one of our listings, and this is the criticized by category, not by name. We're not going to talk about who this person is or the property. But they actually look more mature when you look them up. But then you look up at their licensing and they've only had a license for a few years.
Mm. Now I know what you're talking about.
Right. Right. Yeah. So they look like they're in their mid 40s, which means they should be more experienced, but their behavior pattern is much more like somebody who's lived their life with text messages and never negotiated a high end deal. And then you finally get the person on the phone, and when the numbers aren't lining up, they start disparaging the property, right? Like literally said to me, here are all the problems with this property. And you know, it's really just shocking you want this much money for it. And I was like, well, why is your client even offering on this property if they think it's so horrible?
Are they subjective issues too? Like not?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. And we're like 50 grand apart. And this is a property supposedly being bought for a family member. And I'm like, $50,000 would not want me to put my kid, like if I save $50,000, I wouldn't put my kid into a property that you're now describing as in a horrible location. Like, why would you, like, what's going on? Like, it's just disingenuous.
And another one of the things this person said was, you know, they've already come up $200,000 from their offer. I'm like, well, I mean,
it's because it was a low ball.
That's what I said. I'm like, it was a ridiculous low ball. I mean, why not just offer $1 in your contract and then you can say you came up, you know, $1 million? Give me a break. Just the most ridiculous things were coming out. And I think maybe some people shouldn't be in the negotiation business.
Like maybe that works though, you know, depending on the other end.
Insulting the representative, insulting the property is not a great idea. Especially when it doesn't make sense, right? Like you're trying to buy a house and then you're also trying to tell me how horrible the house is at the same time. Like this is not helpful. We're not getting any closer. So we'll see. We're going to continue to work on that deal. But one of the take homes is when you're interviewing an agent, whether they're your buyer's agent or they are representing you in the sale of their home, ask them about their negotiation techniques. Ask them how they handle writing offers. And if they say, oh, well, you know, if it doesn't start with a phone call and establishing rapport, if that's not in there, then they probably don't know what they're doing. And it doesn't mean you can't low offer. You can offer low. You can negotiate hard. But as an agent for the principal, your job is to get a deal that works for all parties. And you use certain concessions to get there, sometimes planned concessions. You need to know the deal points, and establishing the deal points, understanding the deal points and establishing rapport are crucial to getting past sticky points in the deal. And if you can't even do that before you submit, then you're not going to do that on inspection items. You're not going to do that on an appraisal issue.
You know, it seems intuitive discussing it and talking about it, but yeah, it's so true, right? You have to have a rapport. Otherwise, things get sticky, or you can't tell if the person is mad or just using correct punctuation on the text, you know? With how passive aggressive everything is, having that rapport just makes things slide. And it's also like, you know, if should something come up, like a roof.
Like
a sewer line issue. You know, you should always be approaching negotiation from a perspective of how do we make this work? It doesn't mean you're a pushover in the negotiation. In fact, far from it. You know, it means setting expectations for norms. It means trying to solve problems together. And it means trying to help your client get a great deal. But the idea of stealing the property is extremely rare, right? It happens. I mean, I've negotiated amazing deals, but typically it's when the seller is not represented. Usually the deals where the biggest negotiated discounts have been with FSBOs, where the seller just went a FSBO, and now you're negotiating directly with the seller, and they panic around things like expiration dates on a contract, and they don't know the norms at all. And so you can, it's like silk gloves. Like, you're definitely hitting them pretty hard, and you're serving your client to an extreme degree with value, but you can do that in a way that doesn't feel like slapping them in the face. And you get better results when you don't. When I moved from New York, I was such a jerk in negotiation because the way people negotiated in the city was more aggressive. It still was human, especially the higher up in deals you went, but it was more aggressive. And here, Boulder is such a small town. Very different. Even Denver and Boulder have different negotiation norms.
Completely,
but you still should be establishing rapport. You still should be trying to work together collaboratively on solving the deal or getting to closing.
Do you, Ian had a deal last year where he was able to get, I think, like 6 figures off. And the big thing was he had a rapport with the agent, and I think the agent kind of let something slip.
We know the agent screwed up.
Yeah.
They left inspection resolution too close to closing, and at that point they basically capitulated, and it was really the agent that screwed it up. But I don't want to go too much into detail. So how you structure the contract once you're under contract, when you write up and negotiate this contract, there are reasons why there are certain time periods in the contract that give you an advantage to getting your deal to closing if you're the listing agent, or might give the buyer's agent tremendous leverage if you wait too late to resolve some of these issues. So that's why we try to keep inspection periods to 7 to 10 days, and we try to resolve them before the second weekend has elapsed. And the reason for that is largely because why are we taking 2 weekends of market time only to get somebody that wasn't realistic on inspection items? And if they're not realistic on price, they're probably not going to be realistic on inspection items too. It sets a really bad tone. And what happens is the seller might reserve more money to solve those issues. They should. If there are signs that the buyer is with an inexperienced agent that can't manage expectations or handle their client pushing them all over the place, then usually the counterparty tries to go for more money or protect more money to solve those issues later if they come up. It ends up costing you a lot of money as a client. So choose your representative really carefully and try to get a sense for how they negotiate, and make sure you agree with their negotiation approach. Like, if you don't agree, like if you want to choose me as your agent, but you don't agree with how I negotiate, you should choose somebody else, because we're going to have a hard time. After 23 years, I feel like I have a really good feel for what works in the Colorado markets that we work in Denver and Boulder. And there are norms that get deals done and serve our clients really well. And then there's approaches that are just counterproductive for the people involved, and people are not getting very good representation. It happens quite frequently.
Hmm. Wise words.
Well, there's other great agents, by the way. It's not just me. There's some amazing agents. And I really enjoy working with some of those agents because the competence just oozes out of them. Every deal is so much smoother, and they're not pushovers at all, but it's just the deal goes so much smoother. You're much more likely to close because you work on finding solutions to problems, not dumping gasoline on problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you have an agent that's trying to negotiate something that just would be easier if it just worked, and they're fighting for no reason.
All right. So it's because we've been in my mind kind of complaining. I'm gonna once again mention an agent that I think does a great job, and I love having him as a counterparty. And after closing, I had an issue where the seller was supposed to fix something on a stove and they didn't do it. And my buyer ended up hiring their own appliance company and paying it out of pocket. No, they already hired the company. They just weren't paying the invoice. The seller had agreed to pay for the appliance repair after closing. And we, at this time, I did not escrow, right? I did not think to escrow this bill. It was like $500. We should have. That was the take-home lesson. And because I felt like I screwed up, I offered to pay for some of it. And I called the listing agent, and this is well after closing, and I said, your client is disingenuous and lying, and they're not paying their invoice. And the agent's like, what do you want me to do? I'm like, how about we split it? And he agreed to pay for it. I don't know if we split it 50-50, but he agreed to pay some money.
Nice.
And this is not because he had to. This is, and so I'm talking about Patrick Dolan.
Oh, nice. The there we go. There's the Remax, name.
Remax of Boulder. Credit to Patrick for being an upstanding negotiator and also recognizing the value of cutting a check when your client is misbehaving, and it's not a big check, but it solves this problem and creates goodwill. And that goodwill, a few hundred bucks, is now worth thousands of dollars of free advertising that we're currently giving him on the blog for being a really good negotiator and for working together collaboratively in the Boulder real estate community to keep things moving smoothly and keep people happy. So
call it karma.
There you have it. Karma.
Yeah.
Karma tax. Maybe tax isn't the right word.
Okay.
All right. You feel complete with our negotiation technique? The take home is ask your agent about their technique and make sure you agree with it. What winning is should be defined.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Okay. Next topic, I think.
Knocking them out.
Yep. I lost a listing this week, and it's quite sad because I really enjoyed the listing consultation I had with the sellers. They were lovely. It went for 2.5 hours.
This was normally Thursday? This is.
Yeah, I'm not going to mention the address, but they were awesome. And they said they were ready to choose me before I even showed up, based actually on this podcast and the research they did on us as a team. But I told them I am planning. So in part of this conversation, I said, I need to check in with you on something. I'm planning some travel. And during this travel, I will be working remotely, but I will not be on the ground. So if you need me here for a 6-week period, I can't physically be here, but I have an amazing team. And you can get me on the phone. We can do video calls. We can do. I'll be checking email and working every day. And my team is going to cover during the 6-week period. And when I said that, I felt their energy fall immediately. Like, and I knew right then that this was going to be a problem. And sure enough, they chose another agent because specifically of that. And while I know there's no way I could run and perform at the level I do without you, Hamish, and Ian, and Sophie, like we work so well together as a team. That's the only reason I feel confident that I can leave town and work remotely. Mm. But they don't know that. And so they went with somebody else. And it was really kind of painful because it's a cool property and I'm really excited to see them sell it. I was really excited for us to do videography on this one because of all the amenities around it. I'm just sad that we didn't get the listing, but I also can't lie about upcoming travel. Yeah. I could have just dropped it on them 2 weeks into this that I'm out of here, but they would have been really upset knowing not getting that disclosure in advance.
Especially since it impacted their decision on who to pick, right? Like imagine if you did just drop that on them, that'd probably tank your relationship.
It might. Yeah, they were very cool people. So here's the question. So here's the topic here, right? Losing a listing, there's a price to having a life. And there's also value in an amazing team. And we work our tails off. I feel that very strongly. But there's a bit of a seasonality to that pattern. And because the market's a little calmer from end of August through end of November and beginning of actually end of December, it's quieter. The fourth quarter is usually a time for rest. It's a time for rejuvenation. We do deals every month of the year. I've done deals every single month of the year, but typically November and December are really slow. So September and October are usually a really, well, September through December are a great time for us to travel. And as long as I've got adequate coverage or high quality coverage for my clients, I feel comfortable doing that. Other than that Nevada desert period, most of my trips, I'm actually still working. I'm just not able to physically come to the property, and I've got you and the rest of the team, Hamish, to cover. Mm-hmm. So that's the price of having a life. And it's like a $60,000 loss of potential income based on where I think this property will likely be priced. But yeah, it's fine. Life is too short to count money you haven't made on a deal you haven't closed and not do this upcoming trip.
I think that's how the cookie crumbles is the phrase for that one. Hey, you've been wanting to go on this trip forever as well. You know, like since
this is
I've
a
known
big trip.
You. Yeah.
This is not a minor trip. So, I got to be careful with what I say here, and I'll talk more about the trip afterward, but it involves visiting, India and exploring, ancestral lands and, reconnecting with some of my ethnic heritage. And that just is very important to me, and I've been planning it for a long time, and I'm really excited about it. And, one of the interesting things about the real estate business is the first time I took a trip, this is years and years ago, and Sophie was working as my assistant, and I gave her a lead, and I said, this is probably going to take months to close. And she closed immediately. Like, they bought the first property they saw. Oh, nice. Like, they loved it. They bought the first property they saw. It was a CU Kitty condo, and it was perfect for them. It made sense. And we showed them why it made sense to buy this versus mm-hmm. others. But it was what we would call an easy deal. And Sophie got the commissions from that deal. And I remember feeling this sense of initially loss, like, oh my God, she just made all this money. And I thought I just lost all this money. And then I reframed it and I realized, no, that's the wrong way to think about it. The right way to think about it is she was very successful guiding these people to find the right property. She negotiated a great deal, and some deals are easy and some deals are hard. And now when my colleagues make money, I'm happy for them to make money. I'm thrilled for them to make money. And so, I mean, I wish we could have kept this deal in house. That would have been better, but that's how.
Yeah. Did you offer?
I should have, but they told me they chose somebody else already.
Okay.
And you know, in hindsight, you know, 2020, at that moment, I should have said, "Have you already signed something? Because I'd love to have you interview with somebody on my team that I would partner with."
Yeah.
But I mentioned that when I told them I was traveling, that there are other people on my team that I'll get involved, but they were choosing me. The content
personalities, yeah. Right? Sometimes they're like, that's the person we need. So,
well, and they had interviewed four realtors. They had, they had already chosen four realtors to interview. I don't know if I was the fourth or the fifth. I think they said four other realtors and that, you know, and they were choosing me. Like, they said they were ready to go with me until that moment that I told them I was traveling. And I'm like, okay. You can't get back life experiences. And I think we could have served them really well with me working remotely and you on the ground and Ian and Sophie on backup duty if necessary to solve anything, because there is a time zone issue with India. I'm going to be working early in the morning. I'm going to be working late at night. The middle of the day, we're opposite time zones. Mm-hmm. So it is what it is, as they say in the investment community.
Yeah, that's a popular phrase.
Yep. And my biggest take home is I'm just grateful for the amazing team we've built. It's kind of funny. I ran into somebody at that event in the desert asking about how the company's doing since we had some changes a few years ago. And I told them the company is doing amazing. Like, it's been the best 2 years of business I can remember, and not necessarily counting the dollars, because the dollars probably have dropped a little, but the experience of working with you and Sophie and Ian and the quality of relationships with our clients. And you've met and gotten to know some of these clients. Sweet, and you get the, it's not like you're counting the wrong thing if you're counting dollars in this business, because once you achieve whatever that baseline of success where most of your financial needs are met, you're counting the wrong thing if that's all you're focused on. The right thing to be counting are like relationships with Gary and Thenny, for example.
Yeah, valuable experiences.
Or Dave Jilk, or, and I hope mentioning their names doesn't upset them, but they, I just deeply value
the, are good.
Among many others, that have written us really positive reviews. Tyler and Kelsey, there's so many that sometimes the deals have not been easy, but the relationships have gotten stronger and better, and we were able to be of high levels of service. We were very successful in the goals that we had set with them, and there's just a richness in that relationship that's not transactional. It's human. It's just like a depth to being alive. And so that's what I feel when I think about the opportunity to travel and having a team that can cover.
Yeah. You know, we had a closing yesterday, and I kind of really enjoy closings because it's almost like at the end, not 100%, but the veil of professionalism kind of loosens up a little bit, and then you can really kind of start to talk, and that's just really cool. I wonder how many agents just grab their check at closing and leave, and I'm kind of sad for those clients, you know, that just get high and dry.
Well, so many agents, so many people say they can't even remember their agent's name 3 years after they bought their house. Like, that's how bad the follow-up is. We need to work on our follow-up, by the way, too, with regular reach out. That's constantly something we need to improve on. But the experience was so not great that they don't even remember who this person is 3 years later.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the next topic, because you mentioned that closing, and that closing had an issue that came up while I was at that desert conference. And we tried our best to prevent this from coming up, okay? We pre-inspected the house, and there was an issue in the sewer line that looked like a slight disconnect in the line. And the line's been functioning normally for, whatever, 25 years. But there's some root intrusion on a type of sewer line that should never have root intrusion. And so that means there's got to be a gap in the plastic there. And even though it's not causing a problem, and you can probably get away with sewer cleanouts for the indefinite future, it creates risk. And in finance, there's a relationship between risk and money. And the moment you add a risk, it's going to cost you something. And so we did that pre-inspection. It showed this. And we got professional opinions that said it's no big deal. Just clean it out. Well, lo and behold, the buyer felt like it was a big deal. And even though they went above list, significantly above list, which was great. And Sophie did an amazing job managing multiple offers for this property. We priced it right. And we staged it right. We videoed it right. We marketed it right. All of it was perfect. Dealing with the sewer line issue, they needed to extract a pound of flesh over it. And
we even got second opinions on it.
And I think mostly it's the psychological need to extract a pound of flesh. So you know you're paying over list, and this is your opportunity to claw something back. And it's mostly like getting a psychological win so you can look yourself in the mirror and not feel like
you just paid.
You just paid too much. Like, you feel like some sort of psychological win. And that, I think, was where this landed. And typically when we pre-inspect, we find issues that actually make sense to fix. And then we fix them with our contractor at our cost. Like, if they had chosen to use our sewer line guy, it would have cost them $4,000.
Yeah.
And they would have been done. Even though the sewer line guy said this doesn't need to be done, the right answer was probably just do it. It would have dug up some landscaping though. So that's the other question. But it didn't come to the buyer as a surprise. That's the thing that was important, because when they submitted their offer, they had this inspection report. They knew about the sewer line issue. So at least we knew they probably wouldn't have broken up. And at the time, we could have gone to the backup offer, according to Sophie, but our clients decided to just work with the horse they're riding and not try to switch horses mid-race, as they say in real estate. So it still worked out, but I would have preferred it if we could have fixed that issue and not had it be a clawback on price, but that was a psychological factor.
I went through the same thing, right? I paid over list for this place, and you know, we had an inspection, and I was like, well, I need something because I went so much over, and like, I relate to that 100%. So it's just the truth. Yeah. It's psychology in real estate, right?
It's human nature.
Yeah.
Human nature is to want to haggle. Human nature is to want to get a little bit. And I've had clients just say it feels like they're getting everything and we're getting nothing. And I'm like, you're getting the house. But that's not what it's about. Like, they just, their framework for negotiation is oppositional, not collaborative. And sometimes it's hard. Like, you really want to give, them a win. This is negotiation 101. You want them to feel like they got something out of you. Mm-hmm. And so you plan for those. Yeah. That's true negotiation expertise, is when you sit down with your principal and you say, okay, let's plan the concessions. You never tell the other side that you plan these. And you always make it sound harder than it was, but you plan the concessions.
Yep. And then you act like it's a little bit ouchy and, you know, a little bit of charadesy. Yeah.
You always flinch, no matter what the price is that's being offered. And you always keep a little bit of reserve to deal with inspection issues.
Yeah.
And if they want every ounce of that reserve for the inspection issues, then they waive inspection. Waive inspection and close in 2 weeks, and you can have your price.
Yep. Makes sense. And I mean, especially on our stuff where we do like pre-inspections and whatnot, then it's not even really a huge risk waiving inspection.
I mean, not every seller takes the pre-inspection question.
That's true.
This listing that we lost this week, I gave them that option because we'll pay for it. But I told them I don't think it actually makes sense because you have done so much work on this home that you know it's in good condition. You know the sewer line is clear. The septic's been pumped. You know the roof is newer. You know the boiler is functional. You get it serviced every year. You've spent $200,000 in the last 5 years. You know the home's in good condition.
That this property might be really good for the buyer that called us the other day, actually.
Which buyer? Let's talk about this offline.
Yeah, but
it might be actually, and that's what the seller said is, bring me a buyer, represent the buyer.
Yeah,
and I'm like, maybe. Let me think about our pool of potential buyers. But yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't forget, we also have a Mountain Meadows listing coming up soon too, and we'll talk more about that.
Yeah, that's happening
next week. We're doing videography and photography.
If you made it this far, go ahead.
At least we don't have two listings that potentially could be competitors.
Yeah, that's always a sticky.
Well, it might annoy our sellers when that happens, but it happens all the time because you tend to dominate in certain locations, and I live up here. So, okay, let's keep going on our pricing risk. So what's the value of that sewer line? The value of that sewer line ended up being $6,000, the risk of the sewer line having a serious issue. And that was a negotiation between buyer and seller, two parties that set the market for that risk. We have another one that had a power line potential risk that you can't see where the power lines are going. In 2 weeks, it's going to be solved because the power lines will be there. Can't change where the power lines are going. We don't think it's going to even be visually obvious where they are once they're up. But for right now, there's no way to know. And well, there's no way to know 100% where these lines are going to be. And so it represents unknown risk. And we ended up with like a $50,000 arm wrestling. And then the buyer said they just can't do it until they know where those lines are. So, okay, come back in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Considering it's fun, you know, if you've made it this far through the podcast, you deserve a little peek behind the curtain. So here we are.
You think we're that hard to listen to, Hamish?
No, I'm just, it's impressive that anybody listens to anyone for an hour straight.
I mean, people love real estate. The real estate business fascinates people, and our podcast is very much a look behind the curtain of what's really going on in the real estate world. Otherwise, what they get is sales talk from people that want them to go get a license and join their brokerage. Like, they don't get the reality of being an agent.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that one's pretty well priced, though.
So let's say it was a $50,000 value for the power lines. It's also 2 weeks. In 2 weeks, we're going to know the reality, and it's well worth waiting 2 weeks. It's actually worth it for the buyers too, perhaps, to just wait 2 weeks, but they might lose the property. So the buyer has an opportunity cost issue, and the seller is looking at this like, I've owned this for years. What's two more weeks for 50 grand? Okay. Let's wait 2 weeks.
Yep. It's good for the seller, right? And then the buyer has that risk, but at the same time, just see where things go. I guess there's also the risk of another property showing up that the buyer might be more interested in.
That's also an opportunity cost. Yeah. But there's a bias that happens to people, and that is confirmation that they've made the right decision. So once you've gone under contract, typically, unless there's major problems, you're more likely to, the longer it goes on, the more your confirmation bias occurs. This is, people make these decisions emotionally and then they backfill with rationality. And that's all part of the confirmation bias that rationalize the feelings of why I want to own this property. It's human nature.
It was funny. On the house search and stuff that I've been doing, I was looking almost purely from like a functional perspective. You know, it was like, it needs to have this many bedrooms, this many baths, the bathrooms all need to have a shower. Like it needs to have like at least a garage. And that was all I cared about. And then, the emotions come later. But at the same time, like there wasn't really the whole honeymoon HGTV, like falling in love with the house phase. Like I still definitely don't have that.
That's because HGTV is all lies. And you work in the industry.
Yeah.
And once you've seen as many houses as you've seen, you know better than to fall in love.
It kills the whole magic of it being in the industry. You know? Yeah.
But. Yep. I mean, we got the same thing going on in our house up here in 4 Mile. And that is, I can see, potentially buying a different house and selling this one. I don't think I would turn it into a rental. It's got too many funky things going on that don't make it a good rental. It'd be too high maintenance. But my wife is like, just bringing up those words hurts her. She gets upset. And it's because she's a much more emotionally attached. And I'm like, I see, sometimes a couple dozen houses a week.
Like it's a box.
There's always another house.
Yeah. It's a box with windows. Why do we care? No.
It's not a small child. It's not the love of your life. There's always another piece of property. And sometimes you may not get the same, right? Like there's a home in Nederland that I sometimes regret not buying, but the deal got so sideways with undisclosed issues from the seller that there was no way we could close. We found out they built half the damn thing without a permit. And when we looked at it, we thought the construction was weird. And there were some signs like electrical poking out of the drywall without a box. I'm like, that's strange. And it turned out that all of that stuff was because the guy built all this stuff without a permit in the middle of the night in the 70s and 80s before there were satellites buzzing over and got away with it. And now they want you to pay for it as if it's permitted work. And guess what? When you go to file a new permit, which was part of our investment thesis, was to build out this house to a proper size, they're going to make you tear down all of the stuff that's unpermitted work.
That's insane. You know, there's got to be at some point some sort of like grandfather method for this stuff.
No,
there
isn't.
There should be, is what I'm getting to.
No, there shouldn't be.
No?
It's somebody that did something without a permit, okay, unlawfully.
Yeah.
Should not get a financial reward for doing that.
No.
It's a financial penalty.
But this is like, we're saying we're like 10 years down the road, different owners of the place and everything. The new owners shouldn't get like attacked for it.
They should get penalized for not doing their due diligence. Stupidity has a price. I'm sorry.
All right,
it does
fair,
for everybody.
Fair. Okay.
This isn't my rule. This is just a universal rule for life. Like there's a price for stupidity and fair. Lack of due diligence. There's a price for it. And I'm sorry. That's, you can say it's wrong because it hurts that you didn't know, but you didn't know is not an excuse for breaking the speed limit or smoking cigarettes or shooting
anything.
Up with drugs.
Yeah,
you shouldn't, like, how do you not know?
Yeah.
That smoking is bad for you.
In this day and
age. At this point, the word's out. Everyone knows.
Hey, off topic.
You're still smoking. Okay.
off topic. I was at a gas station the other day, and there was not a single no smoking sign on the pumps or around the gas station.
Huh.
And I'm wondering if it's because like smoking is becoming less and less prevalent, but it was weird.
I mean, most people that use nicotine these days vape.
Yeah,
but I would think, but I don't know, it's not my, I that could be wrong, I don't know.
Well, and then some pumps say no vaping and you're like, okay. But now we're,
I mean, it's possible that device could ignite. Gasoline fumes are very volatile,
but,
meaning that they're airborne.
Yeah.
that's why when they use controlled burns, they don't use gasoline, they use diesel or kerosene because it's far less volatile. And those organic compounds that cause fire are not as airborne. So if you've ever seen somebody light something on fire with gas,
it's,
you literally can light it from across the room. Yeah. It's crazy how flammable gasoline fumes are.
So. Yeah. Do you know the difference between the octanes? We're going way off, but
Well, there's more energy content per unit liter of fluid. That I know.
Yeah.
What else do I need?
The octane is super important, especially if you get into like high performance vehicles, because it is the consistency at which it ignites. So like you've got your cylinder rotating, and if you have like a lower octane, it might ignite a little bit less efficiently at the top dead center or whenever you want your ignition to happen. But then a higher octane will always do, in theory, always more consistently burn and ignite when it's supposed to in the engine cycle. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you get like pre-detonation and stuff if you've got super tight timing and everything, and then you do a lower octane.
Huh, so that's why engines are pinging and knocking if you've got very tight timing.
Yeah.
A very high precision engine, you need higher octane fuel for the. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I get it.
It all starts to kind of churn, right? But yeah, your fun fact with house lines, fun.
All right. We were supposed to talk about high rates and creative finance. We've been into this for an hour. Should we save it or should we just hit on it really quick? I think we could hit on it really quick.
Yeah,
this is a really quick one. So high rates and creative finance. Today we are seeing a rate environment that probably hasn't been experienced in 15 years. And of course, you can read about this all over the news that there's so many sellers that are locked into potential sellers that are locked into lower rates that they don't want to buy. They don't want to move up because they're going to get less house for their purchasing power.
Golden handcuffs.
And people still want to sell. So buyers are starting to offer. They don't want to pay the rate environment. So sellers are buying down rates. That's the most common form. New build are offering super low rates to the buyer, but that locks them in, by the way, because they can't get that rate on the market.
Assumptions.
And we're also seeing seller finance assumptions. Our favorite closer at Land Title told us she did her first VA assumption recently. We actually, one of our listings could do a VA assumption, but the buyer would have to come up with like $400,000 in cash because the buyer has to pay the equity component down. You can't do a second on a VA assumption.
And that's where this is an important distinction to make in the creative financing thing, right? Is like if you have outstanding balance on your mortgage, that has to be covered or that could be assumed, but there's still a significant down payment that the buyer has to come up with, or down payment or equity.
Yeah, the down payment is the equity component. Yeah. The principal balance of the loan is the debt component.
Mm-hmm.
And VA loans, from what we currently understand, and we could do some more research on this, don't allow you to have a second mortgage at origination. But that doesn't mean that once you've assumed the loan, 3 months later, you couldn't just put a second on. So the way I'm thinking about that is, all right, let's say it's $1 million purchase price, and our seller has paid down on their own mortgage. They have, let's say, an $800,000 mortgage, and they've paid half of it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a $400,000 principal balance on the mortgage. In order to pay $1 million, you'd have to come in with $600,000 in cash. But you could borrow against your investment portfolio for that $600,000. You could borrow it from your rich uncle, who could write a gift letter that's unethical and not lawful. That's called mortgage fraud, but you could, and not tell me because I don't want to know about it if you're committing mortgage fraud. But you could come up with some way to get $600,000 in cash temporarily to close the deal and then pay that back with a second down the line. I think that probably falls under mortgage fraud as a category if you borrowed the money. Even if you borrowed it from your rich uncle, if there's some actual evidence of that being borrowed, not gifted, then you have a problem. But a lot of gifted money is actually not gifted. It's family money that is intended to be repaid in a lot of deals anyway. I tend to be very straight-laced, but I will tell my clients the truth about their options. I'm not making the ethical decision for them, but if they get the gift letter, in theory, it's gifted funds, and you should be able to cover that. But that's how assumptions work with VA loans, at least to the best of my current knowledge. This is such a new topic area, assumable mortgages. Like, people haven't done this since like the 70s and early 80s.
That closer that you brought up had been working for 20 years and had just done her first assumption, is how uncommon this is.
Yeah, extremely uncommon. And that was our question for from our client, is how often are you negotiating creative finance deals? Actually, he said, how many times have you closed a deal with seller financing? I'm like, in 23 years, I've closed zero. Like, we've negotiated them, but they usually fall apart because the buyer doesn't have the earnest money. They don't have the down payment. They don't have the credit. There's something broken, and there's a reason they can't get conventional financing. And then they want you to give them below market rates. So you're getting, like, right now you can get over 5% on from Vanguard on their federal money market. Mm-hmm. So you're getting 5.25% free money. Why would you take a 4.5% or 5% more? Why would you be the bank at that rate when you get 5.25% free money from Vanguard or from the Fed, from the U.S. government? So this is problematic, and it makes us have to work a little harder. And I'm happy to do that to get deals done. But
and then we learn. The
reality is that until rates start dropping, we're going to start seeing more and more of these. And we learn, And we learn, and we share that learning with our clients and with podcast listeners.
Absolutely. I think, with these higher rates, we'll probably see more instances of mortgage fraud too. Financing gets a little bit more creative. We touched on this. I ask you about it all the time because I think it's a really interesting vessel. It's a scam at this point, the way you've explained it to me, but rent to own. And I got you right while you're drinking water, but
it's okay. Yeah. I needed a sip of water. So historically, rent to own is usually a scam. The professionals that are in that space know you can't fix your credit in the 2 years that you're going to be renting. And during that 2 year period, you treat the property like you own it. And then after 2 years or 3 years, whenever that option expires, you still haven't fixed your credit or your income. And they then keep your giant size deposit. So rather than taking a security deposit that's roughly 1 month's rent, they've got a $50,000, a year's worth of security deposit or more you don't get back.
On top of the improvements you've made because you're living in it as your own.
And you treated it better until the very end where you realize you can't close and you're losing your down payment. I think it's a scam. It's unethical. And I strongly advise my clients to forget about rent to own because the pros in the game are really just vultures.
Sharks.
Sharks. And you're going to lose a lot of money trying the rent to own game. Mm. We do have one buyer who is, trying desperately to find creative finance from sellers. And we have approached every other week. We have conversations looking at stale listings that might accept creative finance. But the much more common approach is just have the seller buy down the rate. And that way the bank is the bank. There's no balloon payment in 2 or 3 years to be worried about. That works. Mm-hmm. Lease options.
Yeah, lease options are company, interesting too.
Yeah, not great. But if you're looking for creative finance, you just can't stomach the 7.5% mortgage rate. If it's a stale listing, you should ask the seller to buy down the rate. That's probably worth more to you than a lower purchase price, because your monthly payments are going to be lower and you care less about the purchase price. The seller cares more about the final number, sometimes just from an ego perspective. So the sale price is what they care about more than of that sale price, they threw in 10 grand to buy down your rate. It's
odd.
They'd rather. Yeah. It's human nature. People are human. Humans got a human. Okay. Let's wrap this up.
We do got a human.
We're now, how long are we? I don't have a timer.
You don't? We're about an hour 20.
Hour 20. Okay. Yeah. A little longer than normal, but not some horrific 3.5 hour long podcast. Hopefully you've enjoyed this. Thank you so much for listening to the House Einstein podcast. If you're looking for representation in Denver, in Boulder, in Breckenridge, Frisco, if you're looking in any of our mountain towns, I focus mostly in Boulder. I also love doing mountain property in Summit County. Reach out to me and you'll find me at houseeinstein.com. You'll also find our whole team. You can see our other areas of specialization. And we really appreciate you as listeners and as clients and as friends.